Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR News and WBUR, I'm Eric Westervelt.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This morning at a welcoming ceremony at the White House, French President Emmanuel Macron and his wife Brigitte were greeted by about 500 members of the U.S. military, President Trump praising the bond between the two countries.
The beautiful friendship between the United States and France, forged in revolution, has changed the course of history. Exactly 100 years ago this spring, Americans fought side by side with the gallant French in World War I.
The two men are now holding a joint press conference. They spoke earlier as well. NPR's White House reporter Ayesha Roscoe has been following all of this. Ayesha, top of mind, the Iran nuclear deal crafted in the Obama era to rein in Iran's nuclear program. What are they saying about it now?
Well, they're saying that they've had some substantive talks on this issue, and it looks like they're trying to come up with some type of way to deal with the really kind of jam that they're in right now, where President Trump really, he has said, and he said today, sitting right beside French President Macron earlier, that this was a bad deal and that this was, the U.S. should have never gotten into it. But France and the other countries involved in the deal, they want the U.S. to stay in. So they're trying to figure out a way forward. And so it seems like President Trump did say today that they were able to have good talks and that they are getting closer to an understanding. And Macron said some similar things, that they're trying to figure out a way forward on this.
Angela Merkel of Germany is coming also to make the same plea. Please keep the deal in place. But as we know, when the men took some questions in the Oval Office this morning, and President Trump was asked about the Iranians, saying that they'll restart their nuclear program if Trump, as they say, breaks the deal, how they characterize it, by imposing sanctions. Here was his response.
They're not going to be restarting anything. They restart it, they're going to have big problems, bigger than they've ever had before. And you can mark it down. They restart their nuclear program, they will have bigger problems than they have ever had before.
How did Macron look during that statement, sitting right next to him?
Well, I mean, he was pretty stone-faced during that specific comment. But I think that ultimately, I don't think it's surprising that President Trump is going to engage in tough talk when it comes to Iran and when it comes to nuclear weapons. He's kind of always made it clear that that was the stand that he wants the U.S. to take, and that the U.S. is not going to take these type of provocations lightly.
Well, Trump and Macron also talked about Syria in that Oval Office meeting. Trump praising the alliance of the U.S., France, and the U.K. joining together after the chemical weapon attack last week in Syria. But Trump has talked about wanting to get out of Syria. Macron, is he working to also convince him to stay there?
Yeah, that's one of the issues that Macron has been trying to get President Trump to at least make a commitment that the U.S. isn't going to, as they say, cut and run and pull troops out prematurely, or pull troops out before U.S. troops out before ISIS has really been dealt with. The White House has kind of said that President Trump, he still wants to bring the troops home very quickly. So that hasn't changed. So I think the question will be if they can agree on some type of timeline or some type of milestones so that both sides can kind of be satisfied that the issue is dealt with in Syria.
Look, the two men, Macron and Trump, also disagree on trade. They disagree on the Paris Climate Change Accord. And there seem to be many more differences than agreements. Let's talk a little bit about what you're seeing today, the body language between these two men who obviously have some sort of friendship. We remember on the tarmac when President Trump was visiting in Paris, he grabbed Macron and almost knocked him over in like this big kind of handshake hug. How is Macron making his way here, given that he disagrees so profoundly with President Trump?
Well, they are really polar opposites when it comes to policy, but style-wise, that's where they seem to have this personal chemistry. Both men came to power as these kind of political outsiders and rose to the top office in their land, and they both appreciate putting on a good show. Mm-hmm. They both appreciate and want to convey strength. And so really what you've seen is kind of, it's almost a little bit of a bromance where they're like patting each other on the shoulder and talking about how much they like each other. And so they've made no attempt to hide like their personal like for each other.
I just want to ask you a quick question. Yesterday, President Trump's Secretary of State pick Mike Pompeo cleared a foreign relations committee, partly because a Democrat helped him along the way there. But now there's trouble brewing for Trump's VA secretary pick, Ronny Jackson. The New York Times reporting that he drank on the job, overprescribed drugs. How's that impacting his nomination? Just briefly.
Well, NPR hasn't confirmed the nature of those allegations, but there are some issues going on. The committee has delayed his confirmation hearing. Mm-hmm. And also they've sent a letter to the White House asking for more information about, quote unquote, improper behavior from Jackson. So that's never a good sign.
No. NPR White House reporter Ayesha Rascoe, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The U.S. Surgeon General has issued an advisory encouraging people who might come into contact with opioid users to carry the overdose-reversing drug naloxone. The drug comes in the form of an injection or a nasal spray known as Narcan, and it's regularly carried by firefighters, EMTs, and police officers. And now, as the country's opioid epidemic grows, the antidote is becoming more common in America's public schools. Ashton Mara from member station WCPN in Cleveland has our story.
Students at David Anderson Junior and Senior High School in Lisbon, Ohio, file into the auditorium on a Thursday morning. A student group has organized a day of workshops for their classmates about making good decisions, and it starts with a visit from an inmate at the nearby Columbiana County Jail. Brandy is 24 years old, pregnant with her fifth child, and awaiting sentencing for crimes she says she committed to feed her addiction.
Once you do it, you're chasing your high. And it's not fun because it becomes a physical addiction to where you will get sick if you don't have it, so you're constantly chasing it.
The rural school district near the Pennsylvania border serves about 900 students in a county where the number of drug overdose deaths doubled between 2015 and 2016. Lisbon Superintendent Joe Sifke says, like much of the Midwest, his county has an opioid problem. That's why they're focusing more time on educating students about the risks of drug use, like at that morning assembly. It's also why, just last month, they began supplying their school nurse with a new medication. Nurse Kella Heron unlocks the cabinet where she keeps student prescriptions, some over-the-counter medicines like aspirin, and her two-dose kit of Narcan. Narcan is an opioid antagonist, a nasal spray that, within minutes, can reverse the effects of an opioid overdose.
So somebody that's, you know, got a slower respiratory rate, they might be a little limp, like their muscle tone's not right, sluggish, and blue lips.
Heron, along with the school's athletic director, guidance counselor, and principals, were trained on how to administer the drug. But Superintendent Sifke says the likelihood that staff will use Narcan to revive a student is slim.
Our vision is having things available for those off-hour activities because we are such an open facility for our community and loved ones are coming in, seeing their kids perform, doing multiple things. Our main concern was not only during the school hours, but during the off hours.
Lisbon is one of the latest Ohio school districts to stock the antidote. Dublin City Schools near Columbus, it's had Narcan in all 19 of its buildings since 2016.
I don't have any quantitative data to share, but I'm very sure we were the first school system in Ohio to adopt it.
Dublin Deputy Superintendent Tracy Miller says the district of 16,000 students has taken a slightly different approach to Narcan training. Miller says hundreds of employees, from teachers to coaches to custodians, know how to use the nasal spray that has no negative health effects if administered to someone who's not experiencing an opioid overdose.
What we didn't want is for someone to begin showing signs of an overdose, and then all of a sudden they're like, oh my gosh, okay, who's trained to do this? Who's trained to do this? And then what if that designated person, whoever that is, what if they weren't available? Well, the answer is we want everybody to be trained to do this.
In Miller's Franklin County, overdose deaths increased by nearly 50% from 2016 to 2017. And Miller says his community fully supported the local Board of Education's position to stock the antidote. But that wasn't the case for Akron City Schools last year.
We had people on one side saying that we're encouraging kids to use those drugs and overdose.
Dan Rambler is the director of student support services for Akron Schools.
That, I think, is a fairly ridiculous statement.
Rambler equates Narcan to fire extinguishers. They're not there to encourage students to light fires, but are in every school in case of an emergency.
Human life is important regardless if people make horrible choices or not. You still save them. You still keep them alive. You try to get them to be better.
There's no central database tracking the number of Ohio schools that have Narcan on their campuses because it's supplied in different ways. Lisbon Schools got its kits for free through an Ohio Department of Health program. In Akron, the high school Narcan kits were provided by a pharmaceutical company, and the district paid $100 each for the 8 in the middle schools. And in Dublin, the Board of Education purchased more than 20 $50 kits on its own. So far, all three districts say they haven't had to use the overdose-reversing drug, but they're glad they have it, just in case. For Here and Now, I'm Ashton Mara.
We've heard a lot about robots making some traditional jobs obsolete, disrupting industries from trucking to manufacturing. A new report by the global consulting firm Bain & Company says automation could displace 2.5 million workers per year, or more than three times the rate between 1970 and 1990, when computers revolutionized the global economy. Just as with past technological shifts, new jobs will replace the ones that go away, but will those jobs be as good or pay as well? We're going to ask Andrew McAfee. He's co-director of the MIT Initiative on the Digital Economy and co-author of the book Machine Platform Crowd. Professor McAfee, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
So Bain & Company says automation could displace 2.5 million workers a year. Do you think that number's accurate? And how big a shift are we really talking about?
Yeah, there are two things to keep in mind. First of all, it is really hard to predict the path that automation is going to take. So I don't place a lot of weight in longer-term forecasts because previous generations of those forecasts have not been very accurate. The other thing to keep in mind is that 2.5 million sounds like a really big number. There are about 1.5 million layoffs every month in the American economy. We have a very big workforce. There are millions and millions of people working. So we can absorb 1.5 million layoffs a month and still have net job growth. So that raw number is not too huge for me. But I do believe there is going to be another wave of automation and displacement in the labor force.
Of course, this isn't the first wave of automation displacement. There have been major shifts in the economy in the past. Of course, the Industrial Revolution of the 1800s, the Agricultural Revolution, the 1900s, the advent of the Information Age. And some people have called the coming wave of automation the fourth industrial age. Are we prepared for this? And how long will it take the economy to adjust, in your view?
I don't think we're very well prepared for it. Like you point out, there have been previous big waves of technology. Electrification was a big deal. Actually, container shipping was a big deal, put a lot of longshoremen out of work. We were able to reabsorb those people who got displaced by technology and generally put them back into the workforce at a higher level of wage and income, in part because we made some pretty big choices as a society. So, for example, about 100 years ago, we decided on mandatory high school education for everybody. And that was a controversial choice at the time, turns out to have been a really good one. My big frustration is not about the pace of technology. It's about the fact that we're not even seriously considering the kinds of adjustments that might be smart in the face of a whole lot of technology hitting the economy.
We focus a lot on the numbers lost due to automation, but you say we should also focus on the jobs that replace them and whether those jobs can really support a reasonable standard of living, a middle-class standard of living. Talk about that.
Yeah, let's keep in mind that the American labor force, even with a lot of technology hitting it, has been adding net jobs month by month for, I believe, more than 7 years straight. So we are adding jobs to the economy. We don't have a job quantity problem. We kind of have a job quality problem because instead of generating those good old-fashioned American middle-class jobs, it feels to me like the engine of job creation has downshifted and is now kind of creating lower middle-class, more precarious, less well-paid jobs. Now, that is a challenge. It's a challenge I'd rather have than, oh my heavens, all the jobs are going away. Mm. And we can deal with that challenge if we get the economic environment right and if we do some pretty basic things. Again, follow the Econ 101 playbook. The other thing that I would add is to increase the earned income tax credit, which is essentially a negative income tax. If you're out there trying to earn a living, you know, play by the rules, but the market is not paying you a high enough wage, we have ways to top up your income. We can use the tax system instead of taking money away to add money to your bank account. Let's expand that.
Which sectors will see the most jobs lost to automation? Which will see the least? You know, who's going to be most affected by this?
My rule of thumb for looking around at where jobs are going to be confronted by a lot of automation is if you're doing the same thing over and over in a pretty regular environment, even if that thing that you're doing is pretty complex and pretty subtle. So for me, that's everything from a cashier in a retail store who's kind of doing the same thing over and over again to a radiologist who's a very, very well-trained, highly educated person. A lot of their job is very, very subtle pattern recognition. The technologies are reaching superhuman performance in all kinds of pattern recognition now.
I think some workers are feeling like the speed of change is just too much, that someone hit triple fast forward here. Is there any way to control how fast this job displacement and change occurs?
Yeah, it's a great question. And my simple answer to that is no. Tech progress and innovation are both really, really decentralized activities. So trying to think that you're smarter than innovation or you know which ones to accept and which ones to try to stop is a deeply dangerous game and one that I don't want us to play. What I want to do is try to rethink the benefits packages, the safety nets, the environment around this amazing tech progress so that we don't have a lot of people feeling overwhelmed and feeling left behind.
Are big companies like Apple and Amazon, who are doing some automation, are they doing enough to collaborate, you know, with both the private sector and the public sector to try to address some of the issues you're raising here?
I think so. The leaders I talk to in the tech sector and in Silicon Valley are aware that the middle class is getting hollowed out in America, that a lot of people feel like they're getting a raw deal, and there's a lot of stagnation going on. And so when I have those discussions, I hear a lot of enthusiasm for participating in solutions. However, I do not think it's the job of companies in a market-based economy to employ people they don't need. That's just kind of asking them to take one for the team in a way that I don't think is going to work out very well.
You say it's not the private sector's role to, you know, create jobs they don't need, but don't they have a role in stepping up to help ease the transition of people they are displacing, both morally and ethically?
I think they do have a job to advocate for the right policy. But, you know, business is one element of a society. The workforce is another element. Government is another element. Education. All these institutions have to respond to this change that we're living through. I believe we need all hands on deck to participate in solutions. The business community is absolutely part of it.
It's Andrew McAfee. He's co-director of the MIT Initiative on the Digital Economy and co-author of the new book, Machine Platform Crowd. Andrew, thanks for coming in.
Eric, thanks for having me here.
Cowboys are associated with the American West, but in Hungary, there's a much older culture of men still riding the plains, herding horses, descended from Napoleonic times. NPR's Soraya Sahardi-Nelson recently traveled to Eastern Hungary and brought back this reporter's notebook.
It's breakfast time for the antsy brown horses. They tower over Janos Bordas while he slides open the rails on the corral. The Nonus, as the breed is called, rush past the 55-year-old Hungarian into a large stable. Bordas says at this time of year, the herd would normally dine on the great Hungarian plain, but heavy rains have delayed such grazing trips deep into the 300-square-mile national park. Instead, the horses eat oats piled into long troughs in the stable. Judging by their gusto, it tastes pretty good. But these horses, who are descended from a French stallion captured during the Napoleonic Wars, are soon restless. One of the horses wears a bell used to track the herd. I've come to this sparse region to learn about Hungarian culture, which Prime Minister Viktor Orban has often warned is in great danger. There's little doubt that Bordas and the 11 other Csikós, as these traditional horsemen are called, are a disappearing breed. But not because of the threats Orban claims are posed by Muslim migrants or EU officials in Brussels. The problem for these herdsmen is the modern age and its lures, says the Nonus herd manager Robert Slodek.
Nagyon kevés a fiatalember, akinek ez.
It's very hard work, and fewer people, especially young people, want to commit to getting up at 4 a.m. and being with the horses all day and taking care of them. So you really have to have a deep conviction to do something like this.
Their salary is low by Hungarian standards, about $600 a month. But Bordas says his decision to give up a plumbing career and become a csíkos wasn't about money. He says it's hard to describe the calm he feels when he's out on the plain, breathing in fresh air and hearing only birds and horses. He is one of the few passing on the 500-year-old tradition to the next generation. His 23-year-old son, Adam, is also a csíkos. And his 4-year-old grandson, Peter, is already riding his grandfather's giant gelding. But modern-day Hungarian herdsmen have more time on their hands than their ancestors, which they spend performing for tourists. Bordas puts on the traditional flowing trousers and felt hat and mounts up to demonstrate what his gelding named Csomló can do. The csíkos cracks his 8-foot hand-woven whip in the air, which scares me more than Csomló. According to legend, the csíkos used the sound of the whips to acclimate horses to gunfire.
Ho! Ho!
His gelding lies down on command. Legend says that's how horse and rider hid from bandits. Bordas also stands on Csomló. And he's trained his horse to sit on its hind legs. All of it looks uncomfortable, but Csomló doesn't seem to mind. Bordas says he doesn't consider these circus stunts.
What is the hardest thing you teach them?
To sit.
He says it takes up to a year to teach the horses these tricks. Soon we head back to the stable, where Bordas gets to work on grooming his charge's hooves. Soraya Sarhadi Nelson, NPR News in Hortobaj, Hungary.
President Trump today warned Iran that restarting its nuclear program will yield, quote, bigger problems than they've ever had before. And Trump called the nuclear accord with Iran insane. Trump has long been skeptical of the deal because it expires in 10 years and doesn't completely stop the country's ballistic missile program. He's hinted he could pull out of the Iran deal ahead of the deadline next month. The president made the comments at a meeting today with French President Emmanuel Macron, who's trying to convince President Trump to stick with the pact. Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. He's also co-host of Velshi and Rule. Ali, welcome back.
Hey, Eric.
So what do you make of the president's strong comments again today about getting out of this Iran deal?
It's hard to know whether the president believes what he's saying or he's playing to a political base, because the reasons he gives for not liking the Iran deal sort of indicate that he doesn't really realize what went into this deal. The idea that they could have just had a bigger deal or a better deal that involved Iran's involvement in Hezbollah and Lebanon and in Syria if they had just worked a little harder at it. So the president continues to imply that he is going to not certify the deal on May 12th. He has to recertify it every few months. And he's doing this in the face of Iranian threats, that if he doesn't, there are going to be other problems.
Ratcheting up some tensions there. And the French president made the pitch for staying in the deal this morning, saying, you know, the goal was to, in his words, contain the Iranian presence for security and stability in the region. Ali, I guess I'm wondering, you know, American and European negotiators are working on a potential new Iran deal.
Yep.
What are some of the big changes being considered?
Well, a few things. Tehran's ballistic missiles are not included in the deal. It's one of the U.S.'s main concerns. And then again, the expanded Iranian presence. So while this deal imposed limitations on Iran's nuclear aspirations, the fact is Iran is in Yemen, Iran is in Lebanon with Hezbollah. It backs Hezbollah in its Israeli issues, and it's in Syria. It's backing the Assad regime. So America would like it to be a bigger deal, or at least Trump would like it to be a bigger deal. The Europeans are much more closely tied to this deal. They understand the dangers of getting out of it, and they also like the commercial activity that they do with Iran. Iran has 80 million people. It's an industrialized country. So what they're trying to discuss is the idea of amending the deal a little bit or improving it. But the Europeans are very, very worried, and they have not been able to impress on Donald Trump that getting out of this deal right now is not only problematic on its face, but it certainly is problematic in the face of a potential deal with North Korea. As soon as you get out of one deal and then you tell your potential negotiating partner that you're looking for a deal with them, they'll say, well, what's going to stop you from getting out of this one?
Right, and German Chancellor Angela Merkel comes to town to Washington on Friday to help make the case for keeping the deal. And Iran's foreign minister told NPR today that renegotiating, you know, would damage American credibility and open, in his words, a Pandora's box. Do you think the deal has a real chance?
Well, look, Iran, Iran's got big problems. Its inflation has just restarted. Iran, it gets a lot of its foreign money by exporting oil, something it was largely curbed from doing when the sanctions were in place, when the embargo was in place. So Iran has a lot to lose if it does this. But at the same time, Iran has got expansionist tendencies. It is operating outside of its own borders in the Middle East. But they have said that if this deal is canceled, Iran will consider getting out of the nuclear non-proliferation treaty, and that will open up a whole new Pandora's box. So this is going to be hard to see. We're going to be watching this until the end to see if this deal survives.
MSNBC's Ali Velshi, thanks for joining us.
Novelist Lionel Shriver does not shy away from the uncomfortable. Her novel, We Need to Talk About Kevin, centered on a mother confronting her own possible culpability in her son's school attack. Then there was 2010's So Much for That, which addressed the U.S. healthcare system. 2014's Big Brother, which looked at obesity and our relationship with food. Well, now Lionel Shriver takes on the often wince-inducing role of stuff, our property, and its effect on our relationships, in a collection of short story fiction. In one story, a couple's home renovation destroys their marriage. An embezzler flees justice and his wife, but the island paradise he settles in becomes a living hell. Long-ago lovers, now best friends, are torn apart when the new girlfriend doesn't want the old one around. This is Lionel's first short story collection, Property, Stories Between Two Novellas, and she joins us from the BBC studios in London. Lionel Shriver, welcome back.
It's nice to talk to you again, Robin.
Well, I love this collection, and often so painful to read.
I beg to differ. You know, in comparison to my novels, this book is a walk in the park.
Well, actually, there's a lot of humor in it. But start with The Standing Chandelier. It's about Gillian Frisk and Weston Babansky. Frisk and Baba, they call themselves. Best friends after a brief sexual encounter years earlier. They talk about everything. They play tennis together. They are the perfect best friends. Then enter Baba's new girlfriend, Paige. Suddenly, unbeknownst to Jillian, Paige starts planting seeds of doubt about her. And bam, Baba breaks off their friendship. It's heartbreaking. So why drive this to that painful end?
I'm interested in asking the question as to whether or not men and women can ever just be friends. Mm-hmm. And I'm very sympathetic with everyone in this scenario, and that includes the girlfriend who's new on the scene and is trying to get a feel for this close friendship that goes back 25 years. And it's like, who is this woman? Mm-hmm. And she immediately takes a dislike to a woman that she perceives as potentially a romantic rival, but more to the point, a rival for intimacy with her boyfriend. She doesn't like how close they are.
Well, and the property in this story, I think, is the Standing Chandelier, which is this bizarre piece of art that Jillian made and presented to them for their wedding present. And it was such a symbol of her weirdness and quirkiness that at first Paige is like, oh, I hate that thing. Then they both decide that they want it and they keep it. So they keep her wedding present, don't allow her to come to the wedding. Property. Talk about that idea.
Well, I'm interested in property as a projection of the self. You know, when you buy a house, for example, that's you. That's your house. Mm-hmm. One of the most interesting things about the concept of ownership is the fact that it is mostly, if not primarily, defined by the fact that not only is this yours, but it's not anyone else's. Mm-hmm. So it's a kind of patrolling of the boundary between you and other people. And that's why the concept of property, of ownership, becomes so emotionally charged.
Well, so the property in that story actually could have been Baba, the man.
That's what they're really tussling over. Yeah. And that's what Paige, the girlfriend who becomes his wife, is really getting to keep.
Yes, it's very sad. In another story, there's parents of a middle-aged child who will not leave the home. He's happy there.
A pretty commonplace situation.
Very common. It's throat-tightening, but it's hilarious. They decide, well, they're just going to throw him out. Instead, he lives on the front lawn with all his belongings, becomes an internet sensation. People start picketing on his behalf. How can you throw him out? He becomes this worldwide sensation. They are cowed not only into bringing him back into the house, but they give up their master bedroom to him, his girlfriend, and their new baby. What a horror.
I had great fun with that story. I'm interested in the fact that when you look at that situation, you would think that the parents were in a position of power. But the trouble is that when you have a heart, advantage is a disadvantage. Their son's very helplessness, his weakness, he can't survive in the outside world. That means that he has all the power, ironically, because that dependency makes him vulnerable and helpless and someone who needs to be taken care of. And if you're going to be a decent parent, you don't abuse that. I'm also interested in that situation of overlapping territory. Most parents will recognize this. If you have an adult child living at home, it becomes a little awkward whose house it is. After all, when your children are growing up, your house is their house. But by convention, they leave the nest and you get your house back. But if they don't leave home, there's a real tension between who owns that house in an emotional way and even in a who determines what happens to what room. Can they raid the refrigerator or are they expected to go shopping for their own food? It becomes complicated. And of course, that is great stuff for a fiction writer.
And is it great stuff that you are seeing, you have borrowed from your own stories, and you talked about your novels being, you know, lacerating at times. And one of them, Big Brother, which looked at morbid obesity, you had a brother who died of morbid obesity, you told us when you were here before. You know, how much as a writer are you excavating your own stories?
I think all writers excavate their own lives. I mean, after all, you only have your own experience. So everything I know about the world is through my little lived life.
Well, how much do these stories reflect your life? In another one, a man has a meltdown in a TSA airport line. You also could have lost your temper at security at an airport.
Which is not a good idea.
Have you actually gone to the denouement that he did, which was being dragged into a back room?
I haven't gone that far, but I do have a temper on me, and you do not want to go through airport security with me. I have very little patience for stupid rules that don't work.
So that is you.
I exaggerated my own tendency, and in some ways I wrote that to chastise myself, to please, please, please keep your mouth shut.
In other words, do it here on the page and then show the terrible consequences of that and don't do it yourself.
Right.
Right.
The point of that scene was that the character had been under his elderly father's thumb for years, and one more time he's going back to visit his father, who is ostensibly at death's door. And he's very resentful. He's made this trip over and over again, and the guy always pulls through. And then he finally draws the line and stands up for himself in the worst possible place to stand up for yourself in all of the United States, airport security.
Yeah. And by the way, the property in this story, a small chapstick, which is the offending thing in his pocket, which has gotten him pulled over in the first place. And as he sits in this detention that he's now in, that chapstick becomes a connection to his father.
That particular detail is, strangely enough, quite autobiographical because my father always used those plain chapsticks, you know, the ones with the black wrapper.
Sure.
And that smell and even that texture, that because it's especially waxy, I always associate with him and being kissed on the cheek as a kid. He would leave behind that smell, which is very masculine to me.
This is your writing that we've just come to love. After her breakup with her friend Baba in the first story we talked about, Jillian would migrate on her own to their tennis bench, kneeling on the ground, resting her forehead on the rough paint-peeling front slat in a position that only could have been called prayerful, and then she wailed from the part of the body from which one is taught to sing opera. The father of the son who won't move out, who spends hours on a website, manhole.com, which really is for people who love manhole covers. The father asks his wife, "Do you not like our son?" She says, "No, it's not dislike. All that idleness is oppressive. It lowers the barometric pressure of the whole house." Great writing. But it's in this short story form. How do you know? How do you know when something, a bolt of lightning hits you? Oh, a couple laid back, suddenly they buy a house, start renovating it, and he turns into, you know, a fascist practically. You know, how do you know that that's a short story and not a novel?
A short story you can kind of hold in your head, and I'm likely to conceive of it pretty much beginning, middle, and end. A novel is much more unwieldy, and there's something about it that seems intrinsically unresolved, whereas this short story is more like a little gift, and it's already all wrapped up. It is a complete experience in a discrete period of time, and that can be very satisfying.
Well, these definitely are gifts, and they definitely are, although people will be reading them screaming half the time, "No, don't do that." You know, it's just property. That's Lionel Shriver. The new book is Property. Lionel, thank you so much.
Oh, I really enjoyed talking to you.
Southwest Airlines canceled dozens of flights yesterday after a mid-air explosion killed a passenger last week. The airline grounded the planes for emergency engine inspections. Last Tuesday, an engine of a Boeing 737 exploded on a Dallas-bound flight, and a passenger was partially sucked out a broken window. She died of her injuries. Here's the pilot, Tammy Jo Schultz, speaking with an air traffic controller.
Is your airplane physically on fire?
No, it's not on fire, but part of it's missing. They said there was a hole and someone went out.
I'm sorry, you said there was a hole and somebody went out? South of 1380, it doesn't matter. We'll work it out there. So the airport's just off to your right. Report it in sight, please.
In sight.
Captain Schultz was called a hero for calmly bringing the depressurized airplane safely to the ground in Philadelphia. Others said her military experience gave her the skills she needed to respond to the emergency. But the incident also raises concerns about the shortage of airline pilots. Let's bring in Seth Kaplan. He's managing partner at Airline Weekly. Seth, welcome back.
Hi, Eric.
Captain Schultz was trained in the Navy flying F-18 Hornets. What percentage of commercial airline pilots today come from the military?
Well, it's a dwindling percentage. That used to be the pipeline. You know, Vietnam-era pilots especially, any of us who flew on airplanes in the 1980s, 90s, and onward, were almost certainly carried by those pilots. Nowadays, more common for pilots to take a different path, to go to flight school. Very commonly, they begin as civilians, although certainly still a fair number of pilots with military backgrounds.
Why is the military pipeline shut down more? They're finding more lucrative jobs elsewhere?
Yeah, it's, well, first of all, Vietnam, of course, was just that big event where you had all of those pilots with all of those experience come out at once at a time when the airline industry was just set to begin growing very rapidly following deregulation in the late 1970s. So it just kind of all came together at once. Now, of course, those pilots are retiring. They have to retire when they hit 65. Actually, a number of years back, it used to be 60. And that means airlines, of course, need to look for new pilots to fill the gap.
Well, only about 6% of commercial pilots in the U.S. today are women, according to the Institute for Women Aviation Worldwide. So why is Captain Schultz such an outlier? Why aren't there more female pilots to help fill that supply chain?
as with a lot of male-dominated industries, you know, it started with rules that just prohibited them from flying. You know, media accounts out there of Tammy Jo Schultz talking about how she was told no over and over and over again. She persisted, of course, and became a successful military pilot. Even there, she wasn't allowed to fly combat missions. That rule changed a few years later. Now, I think especially with what happened last week, hopefully more of a virtuous cycle of you know, women, young women, seeing that, yes, this is not only something they're very much allowed to do, but somewhere where they can succeed.
You mentioned that the military pilot pipeline has dried up a bit in the last decades. What else is driving this shortage across the industry of pilots?
Well, there was an important rule that changed several years back following the Colgan air crash near Buffalo back in 2009. After that, the rule in terms of how many hours of experience you need to begin flying as a commercial pilot changed dramatically. It went from 250 hours to 1,500 hours. So that means that even after a pilot has you know, gone through all the flight school and so forth, they need years of experience doing something else before they can actually fly commercially. And so that created a huge gap where for several years, you basically didn't have any new pilots right after that rule changed. Yeah, they can work doing other things other than flying for airlines. Ironically, they can even be instructors. I mean, you can have so much experience that you're allowed to teach other people how to fly, yet you're still not allowed to fly for an airline. And so between all the time it takes and then just the money it takes, which prevents some people from doing it, there's been this shortage. Pilot unions, by the way, say, you know what, there's not really a shortage. It's just that airlines don't want to pay as much as it would take to fully staff their flights, especially some of the smaller aircraft where airlines don't tend to pay as much for those pilots.
Yeah, 1,500 hours to get your license, and a commercial license can cost upwards of $10,000, $12,000, I understand it. What are airlines doing, if anything, to try to lower the barriers for pilots or work with unions to try to make entry-level jobs more accessible?
Well, they're giving big raises unilaterally. You know, you have the airlines just sort of recognizing, saying, hey, we need to staff these flights. What's it going to take? And in some cases, they've gone to the unions and say, yeah, it's time to give big raises. They're helping with the training, you know, subsidizing it in various ways. But the impact in smaller communities, especially that depend on those smaller aircraft, just the economics are such that if you don't have very many passengers on the plane, you know, the airline feels like it can't pay the pilot all that much money to fly it. They've been hit hard. It's not at what you call the mainline airlines, you know, the big jets being flown at American, Delta, United, and so forth. Where
it's the smaller carriers that are being hit the hardest.
Smaller carriers, exactly.
Seth Kaplan is managing partner at the industry publication Airline Weekly. Seth, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Eric.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Eric Westervelt.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.